The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Stuart Whittlesome of Odessian Capital, one of the UK's finest investors. So welcome, Stuart.
Morning, Paul. Great to be back on the show.
Yeah, well, we've had a nice rebound in the markets in January so far. In fact, with the NASDAQ up over double digits. So I guess the sort of like the $64 million question, is this rally sort of sustainable? And what's your outlook for the rest of the year?
I mean, who knows? I mean, if everybody knew that, we'd all be piling in or piling out. I think last year was clearly quite a difficult year. It's unusual to have two bad years in a row. We think this year will probably end up positive, but there are so many unknowns. I think the consensus view is the first half of this year is going to be quite difficult, the second half much better as people start to think through and react to whatever recession and earnings downgrades we like to see, and then you can put a price on it. But at the moment, I think there's still quite a lot of uncertainty. But then bull markets are built on climbing a wall of uncertainty.
And yeah. You know,
our market bottomed out in October last year. You know,
so. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it seems as though we entered the year in sort of like a pretty pessimistic outlook, and there'd been a lot of sort of tack loss selling, which led to a sort of like an artificial spike at the beginning of January. But now, sort of like looking through the longer term, I'm getting personally a bit sort of worried in terms of, and China reopening is great because it boosts global demand, no doubt about it. But with regards to the inflationary outlook, it's going to push up sort of energy costs because obviously it's the biggest importer of oil. And the consumer seems to be sort of like a lot more sustainable than people thought and is, you know, it's resilient sort of spending. And it could well be, I just really wanted to sort of gauge your thoughts. It could well be that you get a scenario such that the Federal Reserve is going to have to hold rates longer than the market's currently expecting. In fact, what it says it is, it's going to hold it flat. And when we enter 2024, because we've had a sort of like underinvestment in all things commodity and engineer and energy, particularly, and we've got that distillate ban going in through Europe on the 5th of February, you could get an persistent inflation on goods, which is what we don't want, because we expect it to come down and then it could potentially go up in the second half, which would leave us in a pretty precarious place entering earnings for 2024. Just really sort of like getting your view of, I mean, 2023 is uncertain, but I'm beginning to think 2024 could be equally uncertain.
Look, you can only plan about what's in front of you. And I think the way we look at investing is we really like companies that can, you know, to some extent be master their own destiny and normally have quite a lot of cost savings at the back. So that normally worries us less than if we were investing in a basket of stocks that were operating at peak margins. So, look, you know, there's always uncertainty. I think, as you pointed out, there's even more uncertainty this year. I mean, we don't really do consumer stocks. We've been pretty surprised by how resilient consumer spending's been. And the Q4 print was, in the UK economy, was probably better than people had anticipated. And, you know, this is now discussion about, are we going to go into recession in UK at all, or is it just going to be a short, shallow one? Whereas if you remember 4 or 5 months ago, everyone was sort of predicting Armageddon.
Yeah,
so,
true.
So things move quite, before we start the call, it's never as bad as it seems. It's never as good as it seems. I think you just have to crack on, really.
Okay, good. And then another thing which has sort of been in the markets is M&A, which I know the Odessian Capital Fund has done really well out of, because when we spoke last time, you still own Euro Money and that's been taken out. And then you've got sort of Devro and Curtis Banks as well. Do you want to take us through sort of like, I know you don't select stocks on the basis of potential takeovers, but you're pretty successful at it, right? It's pretty high.
Well, it's not been so bad, Paul. Thank you. No, I mean, we typically have 18 holdings and we had 3 last year. We had 3 the year before. But the important thing is most of these companies are being bought by trade bidders rather than private equity. So we don't think we're as much at risk of, you know, rising interest rates and more expensive debt for private equity, meaning that's going to go away. Virtually everything we've got that's gone to somebody else has quite significant cost synergies, always a significant breakup opportunity. So, no, you're absolutely right. We don't pick stocks because we think they're going to get taken over. Our view is either they re-rate or somebody else buys them. And if you look again at all those 3 names last year, I mean, Euromoney, we've been in don't know, for about 2 years. Curtis, we've been 18 months. Devereux, I think we've been in for 4.5 years, actually. So these weren't things that just happened overnight. It was just the mispricing. So I think all very, very different situations. Curtis Banks, consolidation opportunity, one of the biggest and closest peers buying them. Both of all these companies tend to need to re-platform every so often. Both of them probably have a tech debt, as in an investment to go and that they need to put into their business. James Hay is further on that process. They're re-platforming with FNZ. That should be completed, we think, sort of Q2, Q3 this year. Curtis does need to re-platform, and for them, it's a good opportunity to basically just bolt on additional revenue and business onto a new platform and deliver very quick synergies. So that's real industrial rationale for that deal. Devereux, you know, we were quite surprised by the nature of the bidder. But again, it appears to be an industry peer that's just seen really, really good valuation opportunity and really understands that space quite well. Again, overseas. And Euromoney, really unusual. You know, if you look at some of the stocks we look at, they're quite a lot of mini conglomerates. And we like companies that trade on discounts to sum of parts because it gives an underpin for valuation. What really surprises about Euromoney, it's the first time Ed and I can remember two private equity houses teaming up and breaking the business up on float. Never seen that before. Right. So, and from what we understand, Astorg really wanted the fast markets business, the price reporting agency, the old metal bulletin business for people that remember that company. Great asset and probably worth what the market cap was 12 months ago.
Well, that's what you told me. So you were spot on.
Yeah. And Epiris, I think, they're a specialist UK private equity house. They're really good at spotting these opportunities of taking on portfolios of assets and really working through them. So they were quite happy to take everything else, I think, which is something like 20 business units. So it was a really interesting deal. And again, validation of you know, value does come through in the end. But in that case, it was really good value, cracking business, good growth opportunity. And again, recovering revenue from their events business, which I think people had assumed would take much longer to recover than actually they have.
Yeah, well, we've got a good few unbundling plays we're going to sort of like come through later on. But before we do that, if you put sort of Devereux and Curtis Banks and assume those are sort of cash, what's your sort of cash holding then currently out of the fund? I mean, it must be sort of like more than 10%, I guess.
Yeah, pretty absolutely right, Paul. Pretty reasonable. I mean, if you add those together with a bit of cash left in, it's about 14%. So clearly, we're looking for new homes for some of that money. There's some opportunities to top up and things in the portfolio. And we've got a couple of new names. I mean, we always have sort of the next best idea on the bench. And we're working up a couple of new things at the moment as well. And I think the key thing we're starting to think about is how we bounce the portfolio against, you know, more cyclical recovery plays where maybe valuations are cheap, but there's earnings risk. And maybe there's a bit of balance sheet stretch in one or two places. Bounce that against more structural, you know, less cyclical plays. Because if you look at Devereux and Curtis, they're not really cyclical.
No, exactly. I mean, people are always going to like us, always like sausages and need pensions. Definitely. So with that cash holding, I mean, I know you're a sort of an all equity kind of guy, but I mean, there's some pretty, I mean, the Tina has disappeared now. So, you know, and in terms of sort of like, you know, bonds and there's some pretty good sort of like fixed income plays, and you could even go, I don't know, convertible debt as well into certain businesses.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's not a place we play at, but funny enough, there's the odd listed stock where if you look at the quoted debt and the quoted equity, some arguments, the debt's a better risk-free return or better risk-adjusted return, sorry.
Yes.
So, but that's not really an area we play in. We're straight equities. We don't gear the trust. We typically have a net cash balance sheet. But I think because we come from a mindset of looking at absolute valuations, what are we paying for an asset? What do we think it's worth? One of the things that we think contributed to our return last year is we weren't sucked into growth momentum trades or, as one of my friends put it, growth at any price, right?
Yes.
Where a lot of these strategies done really, really well over the last 4 or 5 years, and the music stopped in the summer of 21, and they've had a really difficult time because there was no underpin for the valuations of all the stocks they held. And a lot of them have derated by 30, 40, 50% or so. And we avoided that trap because we do focus on valuation as one of the things we look for, and undervaluation specifically. So, and there's more things around that. There's definitely more, you know, cheaper value situations and maybe lower growth companies, but there's also reasonably priced growth starting to come back. Some of the stocks that, you know, we'd look at and go, God, that was just totally the wrong price 18 months ago. stuff can become quite interesting, but a bit more growthy. So there's lots to go for. The question, as ever, is where you put your chips.
Yeah. And on that sort of, like, you know, that valuation theme, which, as you say, is real sort of central to the Odessian fund, I did notice you've sold or sort of trimmed your position in Chemring, which is sort of like a really quite topical defence company that does sort of like aircraft flares and decoys, and but also have got that sort of cybersecurity. Can you just take us through, you know, why you decided to sort of like trim or sell that position? Because there is an unbundling argument there, actually.
Mm. No, absolutely. So we'd had the investment for quite a long time, about 4.5 years. And when we originally invested, it ticked lots of boxes we like. It was a global market leader. It was actually underperforming quite material on margin for a couple of reasons. One, the markets had been quite depressed for basically since the Gulf War, and volumes were running quite low. But secondly, the company wasn't particularly efficient. It had struggled with a big debt burden for a while, which they'd recapitalized. And a relatively new team had come in and said, look, actually, we think the end market's going to improve. We think we can improve operating margins. Even if it doesn't improve, you know, the end markets, we think we can get margins up by 300 basis points to 13% through basically just running the factories better, implementing lean manufacturing, putting automation in. So we quite like that type of self-help play. It's a common theme for what we look for. Then on top of that, there was scope to improve the free cash flow generation. And also there were these sort of a number of potential sort of, you know, lottery ticket, a bit more advanced than that, a bit more sophisticated, but lottery ticket programs of record, which had the potential to add significant incremental revenue. And we thought they were really reasonably well placed to run three or four of those. If you look what's happened since, actually, they've delivered on the operating margin. So we don't have that to rely on now. Mm-hmm. They've won 3 out of 4 of the programs of record, and the final one's being delayed. They've generated the automation. So a lot of the self-help has happened. And, you know, when we looked at it 4.5 years ago, no one really liked the stock and thought it was a bit of a mess. Whereas, as you said, you know, it's a much more popular and topical stock. And after Ukraine, everyone realizes defense stocks are a good thing. So we've made a really good return along the way. When we try and look for stocks, we're looking to get 15% annualized return on each stock. And the Ukraine war is a really interesting situation where the whole market fell and Chemring went up 40% or so. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing last March. And we looked at it and said, actually, it's a great company. It's done its job. You know, it's done its job as an investment. From here onwards, we don't have much margin improvement. The programs record are done. So you're really reliant on the sum of parts argument. And there's no guarantee that's ever going to be executed. So we're very happy to recycle capital out of that. They've done well. It was on a relatively high valuation. It's a whole bunch of other stuff that have just been absolutely smashed by the market.
Mm. So, no, I think I love that approach whereby you're disciplined in terms of your valuation and your thesis. And also, I think it's important as a broader point for investors is that FOMO. Don't be scared of fear of missing out. You know, I mean, you've eaten your lunch really, really well. Yeah. But the last bit in terms of M&A, somebody acquiring it or something like that, or in bundling play, I mean, that's a low probability event, isn't it, to bet your chips on?
I mean, it could happen. I mean, we
it could.
Roke, I think last year won its first decent bit of business with the DoD, and you can imagine if it was owned by a US conglomerate, it would probably be winning much more DoD business with a slightly more sort of sophisticated US sales team with more connections, probably. But you know, look, at the end of the day, one of the other things, if we're selling to the market, it's delivered. Always sell something else to the next guy. You know,
I love it. Yeah, no, I think that's an absolute, you know, really important discipline for all sort of like, you know, GARP value type investors. Now, another one we sort of like unbundling play, which came out with some big news last week. Essential, I think it is. I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce it, but it's got a number of sort of, I think it sort of like does information and data and analytics services for FMCG sort of brands and stuff in their advertising or help themselves. Do you want to take us through this one? Because, I mean, the shares responded tremendously on the back of the announcement.
Yeah. Well, they were very cheap before, so...
yeah, true, they were, but...
I mean, look, it's a really interesting play. For those of your listeners who remember in the Mets of time, there was a media conglomerate called EMAP. And this, the heritage
is... Oh, it's
is
that
Greek.
Business, is
it's
it?
It's the old B2B EMAP business.
Wow.
Apex took over, renamed its top right group. And Duncan, the Chief Exec, basically spent 11 years really, really changing that portfolio quite materially. So there's effectively three to four business units left. There's The simple business is WGSN, which is basically a subscription-based business, which helps people, particularly in the consumer sector, work out what the trend's going to be in 36, 48 months' time. You know, so going back to the Devil Wears Prada, you know, you're wearing that blue jumper because somebody picked it or decided like 4 years ago, that's what people are going to be wearing in 2026, right? So basically, surprisingly, everyone signs up to it and everyone has the same trends in 2 or 3 years' time. So it's a very, very good business. And they've successfully diversified it away from just fashion retail. And I think that's about half the business now. And they're going to things like consumer electronics. So what color might your iPhone be in 2 or 3 years' time, et cetera. So, and what functions do people, consumer trends, what are particular people looking for? Not particularly expensive for customers, but basically if you don't have it, you risk losing out or making wrong decisions. Great business, high recurring revenue. That's the one that said category we're going to sell. And we think it's a pretty interesting, attractive asset for, you know, US private equity or alternatively, you know, a few trade buyers. So Duncan's done a really good job revitalizing that. The second easiest ones are the two events businesses left. There's Cannes Lions, which is the sort of industry shindig for the advertising and media industry down in Cannes. Trophy asset. Not obvious who the best buyer is, but somebody will probably want that one day. But that and the other asset, Money 2020, is going into Newco, which will be listed. Money 2020, a fintech events business, growing like a train. Very, very good asset. And then the final one, which is the real unknown, is one of its worst, is this digital consumer business, which effectively has been built by acquisitions over a number of years. And it's really there to help brand owners sell effectively on online platforms. Yeah, so if you're, I don't know, P&G, and you're working out, you know, my Head and Shoulders, you know, what pack size is optimal? Is it three? Is it 3 units? Is it 2? Does it differ on markets? You know, how do I optimize my marketing spend on Amazon to make sure I'm always at the top of the list at the right time of the day? Really, really quite sophisticated. And there aren't that many tools that help automate that for people at the moment. And it's really weird because you have to work over digital platforms. It's not just Amazon. If you want to sell globally, all the standards are different for all the different websites and all the different regions. And how many, what text you got to do, how many pictures, da, da, da. And it's a real nightmare to manage and then price optimize as well. So this tool really helps you. Funny enough, actually, we introduced one of our portfolio companies and said, look, we don't think they use this. Can you go and have a look? And they came back and said, well, they're massively underselling their opportunity on Amazon because they're putting advertising in all the times of the day when no one buys the stuff.
Right. Okay.
It's really fascinating. And they've got charts that basically show that their customers outgrow their categories on Amazon by 2x over time.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a really interesting tool, but no one really knows what it's worth. And there's been some uncertainty because, you know, they took the view last year they were going to put a bit more money into to basically reinvest growth, which hit the margin short term, which one of the things the market didn't like. But the plan of that business is it's largely a US business. Potentially, they're talking about spinning it out on NASDAQ, which again was talked on last year. Now, we think at whatever is £2 that we bought our shares, we recycled euro money into this, actually. That division was in the price for nothing. Yeah. And they spent 800 to 900 million buying all the stuff that's in there. So, so no one really knows what it's worth. And in terms of the breakup value, again, if you're going to sell side, there's a big wide range of what the outcomes could be. And when we originally did our investment note, we came to the same conclusion. We weren't sure where the range would be, but it was at least 65-70% above £2, which is
invested. Which gives you a fair safety margin, doesn't
safety.
It?
Exactly. but it's really interesting. So I dropped the Chivisecker an email last week and just said, look, it's really refreshing to see a board proactively take actions to address a massive discount of their share price by basically doing themselves almost out of jobs, breaking themselves up. And I think it's a really good example to other boards that maybe have a, you know, conglomerate nature where
I totally get it. I mean, if that's sort of like done on their own, then tip your hat to directors because it tends to be sort of triggered by an activist, doesn't it? Or somebody like yourself who's a sort of like a non-open activist, but will work behind the background to sort of like prod them in the right direction.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So it's an interesting one to watch. You know.
Yeah, no, I think, as I say, investors should have a good look at that. Now, in Wilmington, which is a similar sort of play, it's B2B sort of like information technology in sort of like, I think it's compliance for sort of finance and for education and healthcare and regulatory support and stuff like that. Do you want to take us through this one? Because, again, it's not massively expensive for a sort of quite high quality asset.
Yeah, and it's got net cash, so you have to knock that off the feed. So, no, I've known this business for quite a long time. It's a small B2B conglomerate, and a new team went in there about 3 years ago, and they've really cleaned it up. Firstly, it was quite disparate in the number of assets they've sold off, and they've got really good positive cash in for companies that, in a way, didn't really make very much money.
Yeah, I think it's 28 million, actually.
And some of the things, I think they got 20-odd million for their investment banking training business, which didn't make any money, you know. So they've been really good at capital allocation, saying stuff that wasn't going to fit. They've been really disciplined about not buying stuff at the wrong price, you know, during you know, zero cost of money type situation when multiples and et cetera are quite high. And then with what they've got left, they've done a really good job in basically creating two cohesive divisions. And the real opportunity, we think, is on the training division, where they had a number of different platforms, as you know, sort of training has moved from over time face-to-face to much more online. And because of COVID, they effectively created 3 months of corporate change by putting all their training businesses onto one platform. They did that in about 9 months.
Mm.
And they were forced to because of COVID. Otherwise, you know, the business wouldn't have survived. So that's put them in a really good position, not just to grow those businesses, because you need a reasonable amount of investment to put into that. You know, it's a bit of a scale gap. But also, if they're looking to acquire new assets in the training sector, they actually have a platform they can just digital platform.
Yeah, lift and shift.
Yeah, you know, face-to-face business onto. So I think they've done a really, really good job. And it's really been quite overlooked by the market for a number of years. It got thrown out of the FTSE indices, I can't remember how many years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, because of no liquidity. Mm. And they'd really, really struggled for a long time in finding new investors. But suddenly it's become a much more interesting story, and they've done a really good job in reaching out to people. And as you say, people look at Bayshore, that's just wrong for that quality of earnings and the growth.
Yeah, I mean, I was just looking at it's about just over nine times EV EBITDA, and Euro money went for over 21, I think, last year, didn't it? I mean,
your money's probably a better bunch of assets, but even so, you're right. I mean, these businesses have no real D, so it's effectively 9.5 times EBIT, which is not demanding for a business growing 6-7% organically.
No.
So, with a platform and a balance sheet. So, it's been really interesting because around 280, 290, there's a real flurry of new investors coming on board, and you can see liquidity picking up. So, it's a much more supported story. Look, we've done well, we've lightened the load a bit on it and fed the market. And that's what we do sometimes if there's buying interest, because
it brings new investors on.
Yeah, it brings new investors. Otherwise, if they can't get the stock, they give up.
You know, yeah, okay.
And move on to the next thing.
But
you know, it's, I think we look at IRRs for our investment. We've almost done double our money in 25% IRR in about 4.5 years that we've owned it in a market.
Wow.
Pretty much flat.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it doesn't owe you anything, does it? That's for sure. Yeah. just more broadly about sort of like information technology and analytics and stuff like that. Is there any sort of like potential impact going forward from, you know, generative AI in terms of things like ChatGPT? Because when you look at it, and I mean, I'm just, you know, sort of like a somebody works in the sort of, you know, the financial community in terms of writing articles and stuff like that. And it means that sort of like people don't need to spend as much time getting information, and, you know, they become editors and you can do things a lot quicker and easier by this type of technology. I'm just wondering whether it's that, I know that people are talking about it's going to undermine Google's advertising search in terms of that kind of stuff. And I was just wondering, in terms of this, you know, information type businesses, are they going to have to adapt to that new sort of environment going forward?
I mean, I think it's always a threat. One of the advantages we see, we don't do very much on the consumer side. That's probably going to be much more of an impact on consumer facing businesses.
Yeah.
With B2B, they tend to be much more niches, and the barriers to entry, particularly in relationships, tend to be much higher, and also sewing into these people. So you never avoid it, you know, never strike it off your list as a risk, but it's not something that we see as the top of the list of risks for these businesses.
Yeah, okay, good. Now, I know you've also been sort of like opening the checkbook for I think it's a German or a European business that does sort of like, you know, dampeners for sort of healthcare and aerospace and all kinds of different sort of like that. It's Stabilis, I think, or Stabilis.
Stabilis.
Do you want to take us? I've never even heard of the company before, so well spotted.
Yeah, so we can do up to 20% overseas. And yeah. Last March, when Chemring did really well and the rest of the market fell, we thought, actually, where can we deploy capital and market leaders that have been absolutely just share price has been smashed?
Yeah, yeah.
Where those market leaders are really good at passing on inflation and where there's a growth story. And I looked at Starbus, a buyout 20 years ago when I worked in Frankfurt. And
that's amazing. So you got a very good memory.
Yeah, well, it's just weird. These businesses come up and it went through a couple of private equity hands and it floated about 10 years ago. And it has 100% free float, which is really unusual for European businesses.
Yeah.
And its market cap was about $1 billion. So it was good size, good free float, cracking business. And you're absolutely right. So if you can remember the days of, you know, your parents' car popping up the bonnet and putting a rod up to keep the bonnet up.
Yes.
You don't have that anymore. You have a couple of gas springs on your bonnet. You have them on your boot as well. And they have a 90% market share in automotive gas springs in Europe and America.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic. It just owns the market. And then in Asia, it's got 51% and it grows by 1 percentage point a year. So it just owns the market in this stuff. Very, very big economies of scale. It's quite an automated production system. But gas springs are good as well, because every different application of your vehicle has to be tuned. Yeah, so you have not just gas springs on the bonnet and the boot, but also you might have them in, you know, your seat. You might have it actually in your power steering to give it some feel now, because it's all electronic. But that's not a massive growth business. What they did a number of years ago was basically invest in a system called Powerise, which, you know, if you've got anybody that's got an SUV, you know, you don't open the boot now, you press a button on your
bulb
and it pops up. And they have a 38% market share and growing in that market.
Right.
There's really only one other material player, which is another German player. And penetration of the Powerise product is really going through the roof now. And people, you know, it's going from the top end SUVs down to sort of the luxury saloons, da 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 da. Da.
Mm.
And if anyone's got the winged Tesla doors, I think they've got 9 on those as well. I sat behind one on the school run this morning. They're pretty impressive, actually. If you've not seen it,
I need to buy some of your shares to be able to afford those kind of cars, though. Tell me the 2030. After a few buying of your shares, then I'll buy a Tesla.
Never, just lease them like everyone. Yeah. But all pay as you go, whatever, through the company. But the unit cost of a Powerise is basically 10 times what a gas spring is.
Right.
So the penetration is going through the roof. So they have their Q1 results this morning. And their gas springs business was up 3% in Q1, but their Powerise business was up 32%.
Right.
And overall, for a boring automotive business, I think their automotive business across the two was up about 14-15%. So this is a really, really unusual play in auto, and it's not going to be impacted by the move to EVs.
Mm.
And it's you know, if you've got TI fluid systems, no one's going to need fuel lines in the future. Mm. Whereas, you know, this is quite an interesting play, but their industrial business is really good as well, because, you know, as you said, you know, if it's chairs, it's aircraft stuff or healthcare, they make much better margins than industrial. Yeah. It's much more of a niche selection of niche businesses. And that business grew, I think, at 8% in Q1 as well. So it's a really rare growth industrial that's got great market positions, 100% free float. And our view was, I think we bought on a P of 11 on numbers that were too low, with a good balance sheet. It's got to be worth 16, 17, 18 times over time. And if it doesn't re-rate, it looks a shoo-in for ITT Industries in the States.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I think, again, there's another benchmark of the quality of the product and the sort of dominance it has in its niche areas. It's got 14% EBIT margins, which for an industrial and for an automotive company is absolutely top draw. So they obviously have got a lot of USPs there.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't think they're margin maximizing. There's quite a lot of money going to R&D, because the next growth phase, and their investor relations is great, by the way, and their website great, the presentation is really good, really responsive people. But their goal is to get to about $2 billion of revenue by 2028. I think their guidance this year is 1.1 to 1.2.
Yeah, 1.2, yeah.
Yeah, and they think all but about $300 million of that's going to be organic. And the organic opportunity is more Powerise and auto, Powerise and industrial, and then there's an opportunity in auto for in the same way your boot opens automatically, you're going to have your doors open automatically now, you know, rather than you know, pushing your door out yourself. So it's a really interesting play. And again, you know, we like a bargain. And
yeah, no, I'm gonna have a good look at it myself, yeah. Which is good, just so I can afford that Tesla. Right, Elementis, which is a again a reasonably higher margin sort of chemicals business, 13% EBIT margins. Do you want to take us through this one, because it serves sort of chemicals into sort of personal products, I think, in deodorants and coatings and thickeners and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, this is one of our COVID recovery plays. So we bought this. Initially in March 2020 at the back end, when it was trading on half of book value, and the market got really, really upset by it because it had a reasonable amount of gearing. And some of the earnings are quite cyclical. So the business they've sold is their chromium chemicals business.
Oh, that's right.
Which is the lowest quality business they had, most cyclical, and was reliant on the most bought-in raw materials, actually. So the shape of the group's changed very, very materially since that business has been sold, which was announced at back end of last year. And you're absolutely right. You left with three business, basically a personal care business, a coatings and ingredients business, and a talc business. The common theme of all these products is to the end user or their customer, they're very quite a small proportion of the end product cost, but they're a very high proportion of the functionality of that cost, of that end product. So in personal care and coatings, a lot of it is around this concept of something called rheology, which is basically how stuff drips and how it feels on your skin. And their key raw material ingredient is something called hectorite clay, which they actually own the world's only commercially viable source of in California. And they always keep on telling you they've got 50 years supply, but they've been saying that for quite a long time. So that's a real asset in the ground where effectively they control pricing, which is really unusual for an industrial to be vertically
integrated. Yeah, to be vertically integrated, agreed.
Yeah. And they were very, very successful in utilizing their market positions and also that vertical integration to basically put pricing up last year, and you can see that when the results come out next month. So those are quite interesting businesses. They're also taking share, been much more commercial about how they go to market. The thing that's a real drag on the group though is their industrial talc business. Now, like the other two divisions, the talc business is vertically integrated. It owns some of the world's highest grade industrial talc mines in Finland. And they've got at least 90 years worth of supply in the ground. So again, in an inflation environment, you own your own source of raw material, which I think is really, really valuable. The problem they've really suffered from in that business is twofold. Number one, big customers, European Auto, which is, you know, has been pretty depressed over the last couple of years in terms of volumes. And secondly, energy costs. So they have a processing operation in the Netherlands, and the energy cost just absolutely went through the roof. So whilst they've been successful in putting pricing up, they've just not had the volumes to really cope with that. And that business has really, really suffered. Mm-hmm. So in a way, 13 times earnings doesn't take into account the fact that one of the divisions is just not firing on very many cylinders at all.
Yeah.
It's quite an interesting recovery play. It's been subject to bid spec over the last few years as well. It had a couple of approaches in late 2020, early 2021 by US trade buyers. And again, we think, you know, the company's paying down its debt. Chromium disposal helps. It's inexpensive for the recovery perspective. And either we think it does quite well, or again, sadly, it probably ends up being part of a US conglomerate.
Yeah, or private equity buys it. Yeah. Totally get it. And what about Czar, which is a sort of like digital printer? Now, this one sort of like keeps going up and down largely with regards to China reopening. And
fantastic trading stock.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to say, the TL ones will show we don't sell really when it spikes. We just buy more when it gets hit, actually.
Yeah.
I think this is a multi-year turnaround driven by the new team that came in through about 3 years ago, I think, from memory. John Mills and Ian Titchius, the CFO. And he was a company, great IP, but it had been very narrow in how to use it. And the industrial inkjet heads market has a number of end markets that you can go into, be it, you know, where they've historically focused on ceramics and direct check printing. That's probably only about 200 million out of about 850 market. And the guys have spent the last 3 years or so developing new products, new product pipeline to allow them to address the 650 million of market they've never been in before, whilst improving where they are in the existing markets and trying to regain share. So it's a multi-year story. you can only judge them on what they're delivering today, which is basically, are their initial products gaining traction? Yes. Are they regaining share? Yes. Have they launched new products to time? And absolutely yes. And the key one they launched before Christmas was their Aquanauts product, which for the first time allows them to print using water-based fluids. Because in the past, it was only solvent-based.
Right.
And that opens up a much bigger addressable market for them.
Yeah.
And the world is obviously moving to continue to move away from solvents to water-based. Yeah. But it's quite difficult to develop these, because if you think you're basically printing using electricity to print in a product that gets quite warm with basically water that has a relatively, you know,
high conductivity.
Yeah, and high conductivity. So it's no mean feat. And from what the guys were saying, we saw them last week, actually, the interest in the new product is very material, not just from existing opportunities, but actually creation of new markets and new opportunities. So I don't know if you know much about t-shirt printing, but basically you can't
not massive.
Okay, but apparently you can't print directly onto a t-shirt. You have to put a gummy layer down.
Oh, okay.
And then basically print on top of it. Otherwise the ink sort of splurges and sort of, it's a bit like going on blotting paper. But one of the key advantages of their technology is they can print with much more viscous fluids than any other product, the competing technologies, which means you don't need to do the first layer of gummy printing. And then on top, you can basically put the gum effectively into the fluid, which they can print, even though it's much more viscous than any other fluids. So it effectively means a one-step process for t-shirt printing. And John was saying it, really good example of a good opportunity. And they've had hundreds of leads for the new product. So China really hit them last year. They lost 10 million of revenue last year, but they still hit their numbers, which we thought was super impressive.
Mm.
And if you split out China, the business grew at 25%. And that's before they've really gone to the stride of the new product. So
They should see a big rebound, shouldn't they, with their China exposure? Certainly the second half of 2023.
Yeah. So
either way, China is opening, isn't it? So
and they've said it's much busier now. I mean, I think it always takes time to feed through. But look, we're not in this for this year. I mean, we think it's one of the most interesting 5-year stories we've got in the portfolio.
Good. What about Flowtech Fluid Power? Because again, this is a sort of like a high quality, sort of like, you know, fluid pneumatic type of distributor, a sort of niche products and stuff based in the UK. And I think the shares have largely been pretty flat actually over the last sort of like, you know, 2 or 3 years, caught by some of the supply chain issues. So they've had to hold stock and obviously, you know, GDP and all this sort of stuff. What's your latest on Flowtech?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the shares have been pretty friendless. And I think, you know, that's partly a feature of size. It's the only thing we really own of note below 100 million market cap.
Mm.
And I think it is the most domestically focused business we own as well. And I think, you know, the narrative around small caps is, we'd only be domestically focused small caps. So I think it's really fallen into that bucket. And then even if you wanted to go and buy it, there's virtually no free float. I mean, it's also owned by the Howard Group. The direct team at Charles Stanley owns 5%. Judith owns, 8 or 9%?
Yeah, Downing, don't they? Yeah.
There's very little free float for institutions.
Yeah, so the quality of investors is fabulous.
Yeah, we just need to get the share price moving now. So, yeah. I think, look, COVID was really difficult for them. And I think to the credit to the management team, they managed the business through a really tricky period without having to raise equity. So I think that's been fantastic. I think some of the consolidation and getting value out of what they've got is taking a bit longer. But the key now is how they can leverage their online presence, actually, you know, with the launch of the new website. So it's very much, watch this space. We still think, you know, there's a really good 3 to 5 year story in what's consolidation sector. But, you know, I think the market's looking for tangible evidence of the organic growth stepping up.
Yeah. And I mean, again, a broad question, I guess. You know, we talked about sort of ChatGPT. This is a different world. But if you've got pneumatics and you've got obviously hydraulics, you know, liquid based sort of like, you know, parts and stuff like that, and we're moving to all things electric, is this going to be impacted at all? I know we're moving to all things electric in automotive, and I'm pretty damn sure Flowtech doesn't do anything really in automotive. It's mainly industrial side. But can you just give us a quick view on that one at all?
I think for this business, it's mainly the factories that make the stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So
it's not. I think they have some pneumatics that go into JCBs, but that's to make the diggers go up and down. It's not to do the actual sort of engine side of it. So don't really see any particular substitution
impact at all.
Okay, and largely it's aftermarket pool as well. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't see that as a threat for this one.
Good. Now, Spire Healthcare, just sort of switching gear. I mean, this one must be absolutely booming, given the demand for to reduce the elective procedures and waiting lists. I mean, I know my stepmum has had a couple of operations at the local Spire facility, just because she can't, you know, she gets a waiting list of 2 years for at the NHS. Yeah. I mean, what's your sort of latest on Spire? Because I mean, obviously they've got a huge tailwind here for years.
Yeah, I absolutely. So, it's been really interesting to see how they've responded to the bid not happening. So, as you might remember, they got bid for by Ramsay, which is an Australian listed group that has another business in the UK that's actually largely NHS, and Ramsay wants to do more private. And everybody sees the opportunity here. And frankly, the government can't do without them. But Spire is quite unusual because it's really, you know, under the relatively new chief, it's been about 4 years. He's really focused on quality and actually starting to get this business running as a business rather than just, you know, a provider of healthcare services. So it's much more commercial, really to the benefit of not just shelves, but actually to people there. So in the past, you had to, you know, you might have to go and triage yourself at whatever place you're going to. And if you know anybody that's got mobility issues, it's a real hassle getting to and from places. Whereas they're moving to doing all of that online now, which means you can do it much more flexibly from anywhere, which is better for the business, better for the person. So there's lots of self-help opportunity going in the business. As you said, the demand environment looks pretty good. More people probably be taking out PMI as well.
I mean, you know, and the pricing power. I mean, it just is, it's almost like, I know you can't sort of like do sort of like, you know, predatory pricing, but frankly, it's name your price, isn't it? Because if people have got a bad hip and they're waiting for 2 years in pain, then...
Well, my mum's staying at the moment, she needs a new knee. And there's no question about waiting for 18 months. You know, she's a golfer, right? You know, you want to get...
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, the longer you go on not being active, the more you deteriorate as a more elderly person. So absolutely, you think the demand environment's good. The headwind they've had actually is COVID, Paul, because there's still been quite a lot of COVID-related disruption in the business, which has, even despite that, actually, they've grown profits quite nicely over the last 18 months. But without that, the business would be flying even higher, actually. So, look, we like it. There's good property backing. There's still quite a lot of self-help to come through. The demand environment looks good. And these businesses are almost regional. You know, how is that? You're not going to build a new hospital next to them, let's put it like that.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I mean, I'm amazed the margins, the EBIT margins are only 10-11%, are so low actually for this sort of like fixed cost basis. So,
I mean, you'd expect probably mid teens.
Yeah, you would. Easy.
Mid-teens. Yeah,
easy. So, just to justify all the capital expenditure you need to make. Anyway, I'm with you. I think that one, the way is up. Now, one which I've been on my sort of like radar for years is Benchmark, which basically does sort of pharmaceuticals and stuff like that for fish and for salmon and trout and all kinds of stuff like that. Now, I've got a bit of sort of history to it because I used to work for Unilever and we used to own Marine Harvest, which used to do a lot of sort of like fish farming. And all the fish used to, one year would be rave and have a great crop, and then the next year would all die of fungiotis and stuff like that. So I was just, it keeps going up and down out of favor, Benchmark. And I know it's got another listing. Do you want to take us through this one?
Yeah, I mean, look, the aquaculture sector, as many long-term investors would know, has not been a beacon of light.
Yeah, I mean, going not recurring to, you know, revenue streams, 20, anyway.
20 or 30 years, it's always been a difficult place. But look, we think Benchmark's now in a really interesting position. You know, it's had a, again, common with many of our holdings, Paul, significant management change over the last 3 years.
Yeah, okay, good.
And a new team that is extremely focused on efficiency and capital, return on capital. So three parts of the business, there's a specialist nutrition business. So it's not just, you know, bulk feed. It's much more specialist feed, particularly for really, really small, almost developing fish, which, you know, basically is much more a niche market. The second business is a genetics business, which is involved in basically producing salmon eggs and it's about to go into disease-resistant shrimp as well. And effectively, a lot of the salmon farmers, some of them do them in-house, and the quality is not as good as potentially buying from Benchmark, where there's much more disease resistance. So that's an interesting business, pretty capital intensive, but a good business. And the aquaculture sector is, we think, 15 to 20 years behind porcine, bovine and poultry.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And it's much more cottage industry. So you'd expect the sector to mature in a very, very similar way to those assets. Those two businesses make money, cash generative, could be making more, needs a better return on capital employed. The third division has been this sort of the problem child for a while, which is their medicines business, effectively, which had this new novel product and service for basically treating sea lice. And sea lice, if anyone knows about salmon farming, is the big problem for the industry. I think people say it costs $700 to $1 billion a year. And the existing, if you put chemicals in the pens, which is what they historically did, over time the sea lice become resistant.
Mm.
The other alternative is mechanical brushing. They're literally sucking fish onto a ship, brushing the stuff off, which damages the fish. So they've come up with a new chemical treatment, but actually a system where you effectively suck the fish onto the boat, treat them with a chemical, wash the chemical off, get the lice off, put the fish back into the ocean without the chemical going back into the ocean. So it's a closed loop system, which means it should have much more efficacy for a much longer time than existing solutions. And they've launched it, they've got approval, they've gone from trials to actually starting to sell commercially, but it's taken longer than people thought.
So
for the first time I think I can remember, it's looking to generate some cash next year. Albeit the first two divisions do generate cash, it's the healthcare business that's been sucking all of it up.
Yeah.
And it's quite frenetic in the UK as well. It's on AIM, but none of the IHT people really are there. And the top three shareholders own 60% of it, two of which are Norwegian. So effectively, the view of the board has been, and the shareholders, look, there's a much deeper knowledge and asset, knowledge and appreciation of assets in the Norwegian market. Norway's its biggest end market. Let's look at dual listing on Euronext as a first step, and then potentially moving to full Oslo listing and canceling the AIM listing. So that could be quite an interesting catalyst, but it just means no one in the UK that can't is going to buy it that can't own Norwegian stock.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Gotcha. So, well, it sounds like it's got a lot of IP, and it's one of the very few, isn't it? Sort of like aqua tech type groups. But we'll wait and see. I mean, okay, the other thing I suppose is not only the sea lice with salmon, it's also the sea lions who think, "Well, I'll have some of those salmon, please. Thank you very much." they're nice and fresh. Now, moving a bit more onto the tech side, a company which I don't normally talk about much is RWS, which is, I think, is a combination of their old sort of like the patent translation business, and they bought SDL I think a few years back and put in their sort of like website translation software as well. Do you want to take us through this one in terms of, they make sort of like pretty good margins, sort of 17-18% EBIT margins, and trading at roughly a good valuation, actually 15 times PR with cash on the balance sheet.
That's right. So we inherited this position because we were SDL holders. And SDL, prior to the bid approach, I think was our top investment at 14% of the fund, and then it got bid for at a big premium. So we've been basically selling down for quite a long time, carefully. Okay. And the shares really took a whack last year. I think a number of things. New chief exec came in, and we felt the business had been a bit bootstrapped. There's lots of synergies coming from SDL, but there was a need to reinvest to basically put a bit more structure around the business. It was, again, quite bootstrapped, quite a really lean head office. And that meant a slight short-term earnings downgrade to hopefully deliver better growth and margin. And the market 12 months ago has hated that news.
Yeah.
So it took a bit of a knock then. On top of that, it as a relatively big AIM stock, had lots of the AIM growthy type investors. And again, it probably had started on a rating that was probably a bit too rich. And again, rating we were probably saying down at. But the baby went out with the bathwater and got really cheap last year. So we bought back in, had a bid approach at one point last year from I think probably pretty speculative and not at a level that people would be interested in. But it is a good business. It's had a couple of headwinds. The European patent regime change is probably knocking a bit off the earnings, but we think most of that impact is through or certainly in the price now. And it remains a really interesting sector. I think it's pretty consolidated globally. It's one of the top three players. One of the other big players is owned by private equity and about to change hands. There's probably massive synergies, but putting them together. So, that might happen. Yeah. Alternatively, they've got a good balance sheet to go and do some more consolidation themselves. So I think it's a really interesting watch this space. Company, but you know, it's not something that we'd necessarily rush to get into in a bigger way because it's quite a big market cap. But
No, I mean, on less than 11 times EBIT, then it looks good value to me, certainly for a high quality. Now, Dialolite, which does sort of, again, I think this one's been over the years up and down. It's sort of like manufacturer of industrial sort of, you know, LEDs and those type of applications. You'll take us through this one because it's got quite low margins. I mean, it's a sort of like it doesn't seem to fit the sort of the Odessian sort of a high quality sort of like IPR type. It's a 4% EBIT margin, which is what I would have expected it to be.
Yeah, so well spotted. I mean, I've done this business quite a long time. I looked to take it private 20 years ago when it was called something called Roxburgh Group.
Gotcha.
Very, very, very different. But no, we've been in this for about 18 months, and the story here is a company that has basically had suffered from material self-harm and things going wrong over the last five years.
It's the opposite to self-help.
but it has turned the corner. I mean, if you look back in the midst of time, you're absolutely right. Electronics manufacturing, LEDs, there's probably more IP than people think in it because there's around getting reliability in the power supply, the way that the light shines down, and you get the max light from certain electricity. But their real focus is in really, really robust industrial areas such as chemical plants or industrial plants where there's lots of vibration, abrasion, and where you basically can't have your light fail. Because if your light fails, you have to stop the factory. So, and they guarantee their lights for 10 years. So it's much more the more robust, resilient end. Bizarrely, you'd expect every part, you know, to have LED lights. A lot of them don't. They think the penetration is like 25 to 30%, and where they've been really, really successful and where their product works really well is particularly in the oil and gas industry. And given where the oil price is, the demand there looks really good at the moment. Where they replace sodium lights or the equivalent, the power usage is somewhere between 25 and 50% of the incumbent system. So you know there is really good payback with energy costs going high. Obviously, the payback's much quicker. And again, people want to buy quality. There's basically a handful of people that they trust because no one wants another Deepwater Horizon by buying a self-certified Chinese product. So demand's good. They've had problems. They outsourced manufacturing to somebody who basically couldn't make it. They had to bring it back in-house.
Which is always a problem.
I mean, you know, because they have, you know, if you look at their SKUs, you know, the number of SKUs they've got and the volumes they do, it just didn't work for the outsourcing partner. Massively destructive, brought it all back in-house, then COVID happened. So it's really had like a number of perfect storms in sequence. But the product is good. You do the referencing with customers. People think the quality is really high. They're starting to interestingly get repeat business from product they sold 8-9 years ago. One of the case studies on the website is DS Smith. They basically did all the lighting for the DS Smith factories around the world, up in Germany. And some of that stuff is coming into about 8 or 9 years. So you've got increasing penetration plus people starting to replace now. So really interesting time. But yeah, the margin's not there. You know, it should be making, we think, comfortably in the 40s, maybe low 40s. And it's been impacted by supply chain issues. You know, they've been having to freight components around the world to get stuff there in time. One of the chips they use and one of their product normally is 60 cents. They were having to pay $30 for them last year. And on the distributed market, you're having to pay 120. So it's been lots of headwinds I've had to deal with. And then on top of it, post-Thanksgiving, business was quite slow in the States, and it tends to be a Q4 weighted business. So they've had a bit of a hiccup. We think it's got a lot of potential. Nothing's really in the price for that potential. It's clearly not for widows and orphans, but again, you'd be surprised if it was independent in 3 years' time because it's to be independent local.
And as you say, if they can actually get that self-help going and increase the gross margins to over 40% from about 35%, then that's all going to drop through to the bottom line. And you'll actually see, given the EBIT margins of 4%, if you put 5% on top of it, you've doubled your profit, haven't you, on your EPS straight away. So
the sales should grow. You know, I think the markets, despite the disappointment, they grew 17% last year, constant currency. The market, I think the expectation is 7% this year. We think that's pretty conservative. And they should do better than that. And it's a US business. 70% of revenues in the US. It's one of these accidents in history. It's listed here.
Mm. Now, another one in the cyberspace, which is actually probably the cheapest sort of sector play that I've seen, is NCC, which, again, is a bit of a potential unbundling play. It's got a sort of like cybersecurity consulting business that I think is growing pretty well. And then it's had this software escrow business that has actually, I think, it's sort of flatlined over the last sort of like 18 months or so. So you'll take us through this one, because it goes in and hasn't really moved actually for a few years.
Again, it's a great trading stock again.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, look, it's absolutely. Yes, there's an unbundling play. Relatively new chief executive. I think we'll know more next week because
got results. Is it?
Yeah, it's got results, and he's coming out with his state of the nation, what he thinks he's going to do for the business. Mm. So, I think look, the cybersecurity business, it's a good business. There aren't that many independent ones still around, but there's the real potential to upsell. So typically they're selling at a lot more an operational level rather than a strategic level. Mm. And if they can start to really sell more towards the C-suite and get, you know, there's some really interesting potential growth to come through there. And that's really his background, Mike's background in YouTube exec. He built EY's cybersecurity business to, right, I think, $600 million of revenue or so. So, you know, he knows lots of people in the industry. He's very well connected. And really, we think that's going to be 99% of his focus. The escrow business, you're absolutely right. Relatively low growth, cash cow. It was very supportive for the cybersecurity business when it was growing very fast and wasn't generating much cash. But the cyber business stands on its own now.
I'm with you. I mean, it doesn't seem logical at all, really, to have that software there, because it just impacts the other growth area on the consulting side, in my view. But hey.
Yeah. So I think interesting. If you look at the chairman's background, you know, Chris Stone, he's well known as not being afraid to split businesses up and sell things. So you know, he's pretty proactive. Is it the right time to sell that business? Are you going to get fair value today? Probably not. I think they need to try and prove they can get the growth coming back, and then it's probably in a much better position to sell.
Yeah, agree. Okay, right. Well, final then. We've got Vivendum, which I think is the old VTech business, actually. It's just sort of like, you know, camera hardware and software, and really for the sort of creative industry. Do you want to take us through this one? Because, again, I think it's actually done, it did reasonably well, and then it's sort of, I guess, been a bit sold off because of the, it was classed as a bit of a stay-at-home stock, but it may not be, in fact.
Well, I think it's more the opportunity. We think it's more about the vloggers, and that, you know, if you, but again, I looked at taking this private, I don't know, 19 years ago or so, and they were basically the dominant provider of the big massive TV cameras you see from footage on, you know,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes.
And it's a very, very different business now as technology's changed, and the chief exec has been there quite some time. Stephen Bird has done a great job in basically using M&A to re-transform it into a company with much higher organic growth, re-tapping into the vlogger trade and the YouTuber generation. And also really shifting almost from a B2B business to parts of it much more B2C.
Yeah.
And really, really driving product innovation. So, if you look at their Joby product range, I think their Gorilla thing that you can use to hold your camera. I mean, they're fantastic, really class-leading products. The shares are pretty liquid, though. So, again, pretty concentrated. It's not massively owned by people. And, it's got probably a bit more debt than average. So people, not sure how it's going to be impacted by the recession, actually. I don't think it's as much the stay-at-home stuff. It's more, how's demand going to hold up? Again, results coming up in the not-too-distant future. It's pretty difficult to buy, funnily enough.
Is it? That's surprising. Half a billion market cap business. That is surprising.
Yeah. I mean, we put some money into it. We followed it for a long time. You know, we think Steam's done a very, very good job, and it's a well-run business. And again, there's probably a sum of parts argument there. You know, not all three of the divisions maybe sit together. I think the other thing is, cash flow is pretty good. I think it's on a 7% free cash flow post tax.
Yeah, I mean, EBIT multiple is only 10. So, it really isn't on a racy multiple at all.
And I think compared with where it was 5-6 years ago, you really struggled to see who'd be interested in the business other than the stock market 5-6 years ago. I think it's a much more interesting asset now.
Yeah.
So, look, you never say never. I think as the debt comes down, they pay down the debt, it probably becomes more interesting once people know what earnings are going to do this year. I think people can, you know, the marginal buyer might be able to put a price on it. So I think it's interesting. We really liked it because, again, if you're going to investor presentations, you know, we like market leaders, Paul. So you're a market leader, you control pricing in your markets.
Yeah.
I think they've got relative market shares of 4 to about 7x in their markets. They're just they're the biggest by miles.
Yeah,
and we spoke to Stephen last March and said, look, how successful are you going to pass pricing on in inflation periods? And he said, you know, he was more than comfortable with maintaining margins.
Right. Yeah, if you've got the quality, if you've got the quality, then you can push the prices through because people are going to go for it, aren't they? It becomes the effectively the de facto standard.
Yeah. So again, that was one of the key attractions. I think we bought in last year, and I think 10 and a half times earnings, which we felt was mispriced. That's one of the things we recycled Chemring into, actually.
Good. So. Okay. Well. Thanks very much for taking us through all those and for your insights. And absolutely, big congrats last year, because I think you're one of the best performing funds out of the in the UK. So
Just pipped by Mr. Stavely, but
well, you have to beat him this year in 2023. Now, if people want to actually put some money into Odessian Capital, Stuart, how best to do it?
So all our money is managed by a quoted investment trust, a Odessian investment trust.
Yeah.
We'd always suggest people get their own financial advice before looking, but as a public company, it's accessible to anybody, and there's tons of information on the website. But again, we always suggest people consult an advisor before they invest.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks for those ideas and look forward in touching base in about 6 months' time. Cheers, Stuart.
Thanks, Paul. Take care.
Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.